Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 294 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host, as usual. Today, my guest is Joe DiMaria. And Joe is really an interesting guy. He does a number of different things. He's built a lot of different businesses in the digital marketing space. He's helped a lot of other businesses scale in extraordinary fashion. I guess I would call him a marketer at heart. He's also very involved in terms of educational curriculum building for businesses, and that's a centerpiece of his approach to differentiating businesses from their competition. And right now he's helping a law firm do exactly that through his expertise. And he's just a fascinating guy to chat with, and I hope that you learn as much from him as I did in the discussion that we had. So without any further delay, here is Joe DiMaria. Joe DiMaria, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey, thanks for having me, Neil. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you with us today, Joe. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, I started about a decade ago as an online marketer. I actually dropped out of law school. So that was fun.
a lot of good decisions made early.
Yes, exactly. I actually had an attorney, who was a professor, that told me the happiest day of his life was the day he retired and took an art class. And I said, you know what? That's probably a good sign for me to get out of here while I'm still, while I still have my wits about me. So I ended up pulling out that day and going and starting a business. So my background started in tech. I was working in the Silicon Valley, which is where I'd grown up initially. Mm-hmm. And then slowly over time, I shifted more into this entrepreneurial space and started working with, you know, high-end entrepreneurs like Damon John, you know, from Shark Tank and all these different folks. Kind of took me into, at this point, hundreds of different industries and niches, including currently running a law firm with a good friend of mine. And, you know, amongst other things, I've built a $50 million startup around education in Silicon Valley a few years ago. So I've had a pretty wide swath of experiences that I've taken with me. And, you know, I've used those things to scale companies in a lot of different industries over the past few years, just from taking what's worked in a lot of different sectors.
Well, you know, you make it sound, you know, so easy. You take what works and you turn it into a $50 million effort. But I know it's not nearly so so easy to pull off. What I wanted to spend some time chatting with you about, I know now that your passion is located around an opportunity called Teach to Scale. Tell us how that came about.
So it all happened sort of on accident, in that I'd been running my online marketing agency for several years, and I sort of backed into being a principal in a venture-backed education company. And it was really just at first as a consultant, but I saw a lot of upside. It was very small. It was struggling a lot. And there was a tremendous amount of untapped potential. So my former business partner and I at the time, we took a significant stake and role in that company. And we ended up building it out to become, you know, one of the first edutech, is what the sector is now called.
Right.
But venture-backed edutech startups to break $50 million. It's now a $120 million company, but I left at 50. And so in that time, we scaled it from 66,000 annual revenue when I arrived to 15 million 18 months later. and from 1 million valuation to a 50 million valuation in the same time period. And the truth of the matter is that it was not that difficult. It's just an equation. So if you know what you're looking for, you don't need to be very, you don't need to be a genius to figure it out. You just need to know what to do. So we were lucky there, and it sparked a passion and education for me. And I know that we build those kinds of companies well. So I went on to help a lot of folks that were trying to build similar education pillars into their primary businesses.
Well, the reason it has so much resonance with me, it's really twofold. One, I like to think of myself as a teacher by nature. You know, I tell people a lot of time, I'm not the greatest lawyer in the world, but I can teach you about what it is that I do and why I do it. Same way in my previous lifetime, I used to own and operate a martial arts studio. And I would tell people I'm not the greatest martial artist in the world, but I'm a pretty good teacher. And so this really kind of resonates with me. And in particular, on the second part of that is that there are more and more attorneys and law firms looking to create products and services to make the delivery of legal services more equitable to the community, and really to capitalize on the growing, as you said, the growing aspects of edutech. And I think there's a big opportunity here for attorneys to take a look at what you do and see how they can benefit from it.
Absolutely. I mean, like the funny thing is it's common sense. And this is something that people don't think about, which is shocking to me, but I'll be honest in saying that I didn't really think about it until I built a company doing it. Mm-hmm. But you can go back. I mean, modern advertising only started in the 1890s. And that's because prior to that, banks didn't want to work with basically, they didn't want to lend to companies that needed to advertise. They thought it meant the company was weak. So because banks wouldn't work with folks, people wouldn't advertise. The minute that sentiment changed, you have the start of the modern advertising industry. But if you look at the big golden thread in successful advertising from the 1890s until like 2008, the thread is education is the thing that makes marketing and advertising campaigns the most successful. The best sales letters, the best advertising, all of like the best offers, all of those things were usually based around education for over 100 years. That's the trend line. Go ahead.
Isn't that interesting? Because I think you or oftentimes people think that the key in advertising is really coming up with that, you know, killer brand, either the branding image or the marketing slogan or, and that all has a role to play. But the greatest slogan is not going to overcome a crappy product.
Of course, right? Pretty much never, right? I mean, the reality of things is, you know, I think it's really difficult. And frankly, it puts, you know, attorneys and folks like that at a significant disadvantage, because all you've seen over the past 15 years since the internet marketing revolution, I'm talking, you know, 07, 08 is when it started, is this really big focus on brand, on, you know, the way things look and feel and how nice our website is and all these different things. But what ends up happening in the industry is that we just end up looking at the one guy that gets really successful, and then we just copy all their stuff. If they get a nice website, then we have to go get a new nice website. If they start doing stuff on social media, oh, we should start doing social media. And it becomes very reductive. And the issue with that is there's no differentiation. We're not focused on building better relationships with clientele that differentiate us from our competitors. We're focused on the way we look, and that sort of inward focus on looking cool is holding us back from being, you know, preeminent in our space. And this is a thing that I've had this issue with my clients in the legal field for a while, and my clients in the financial sector and all that, which is they're typically pretty starched collar, buttoned down industries, and everybody's afraid of doing anything different than their competitors. They just want to copy someone making more money than them. But if we're copying our competitors, the best we can hope for is to copy them exactly And that just brings us to parity. We can't beat them by copying them. You can't be preeminent by copying folks. And the reality is, no one is capable of being a perfect copy. So you will miss behind the scenes factors, little bits of automation or processes or, you know, operational components that give them leverage that you don't utilize. And you end up being a poor copy. And you wonder why spending years of your time, your money, why you've hired agencies and vendors, or you've brought in internal staff and tried to scale that way. You wonder why those things don't work. It's because you have not employed something that is going to empower you to be successful. You've just gone out and become derivative. Of course, you're never going to break that, you know, 2 million marker to where you can get into that scalability phase.
It's so interesting to me that when you do, just as you said, when you try and model, to put it in maybe more upscale phrase, successful folks, but really, when you get down to it, you're copying them, just as you said, right? Yeah,
you're copying.
You know, what you end up doing is leveling out everything. So as you said, you become a copy of something that maybe that you're not, that's not even you, and everybody looks the same. And so when people say that the prospective client can't tell the difference between one lawyer and another, you've made it that way.
Absolutely. You've empowered your client to only price compete. That's it. That's all you have now. And then you get mad that you can't charge the prices you want to charge, or that your competitors are undercutting you, because you've created this market parity. Like it doesn't functionally make sense for us to all participate in a race to the bottom, this de facto race to the bottom, based on the fact that we're all copying each other. We're literally creating the even playing field that we're complaining our head against.
Yeah, right. We're creating the situation that we're complaining about, which absolutely is just find so fascinating. Tell me then your views on how is it that we go about the process of educating as a methodology for differentiation.
I mean, you mentioned it. There's a lot of, you're seeing it now in the legal space, but I mean, every industry, every service-based business is starting to find that education is a more and more important differentiator. You've seen folks baby step into this with things like webinars, or even as simple as, you know, Facebook Lives, or right, putting out a blog and things like that. And all of those are valuable, right? They all have their own, let's call it, they all have their own pillar in the Parthenon. Like it matters. But the principal thing and the biggest mistake that folks make is all of them are valid, but it's the intent, what I would call a strategic intent, that makes any of those things worth a damn. So I apologize. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say that.
You certainly are.
Okay, great. So when I talk about a strategic intent, you know, a lot of folks, they put a webinar out because they're trying to make a sale. They're not putting a webinar out because they're genuinely trying to educate or genuinely trying to be valuable. There's a difference there. But when you look at the company and you evaluate where you want to go and how you want to stand in your market, if you want to be preeminent as the educators that have informed buyers, that, you know, speeds up your sales process, makes things a lot smoother when folks know what they're buying, if that's the position you want to take, then everything you do should be designed not around making you look good, but it should be designed around how do you make it an easier decision for them to buy? How do you make it easier for them to understand the process, to know what's going on, to understand the value of what you're doing? Because you know this, Neil, but there can be, you can have a service and the same service downtown could be 10x more expensive. Folks are just going to see the price. If they don't understand the difference between what the level of service is, they're just going to price compete always, right? Like the worst thing that happens in the legal space is everybody goes in and they type in, you know, patent attorney near me, and they have now a list of names, and they're just going to dial for dollars. Basically, they're going to figure out who's going to give them the cheapest deal, but they're not informed enough to know what the difference is between, you know, someone's search or someone's evaluation or someone's this or someone's that. They just hear a number and they make a decision. But you have, if you genuinely know that you're the best in your space, even if you're not marketed the best, you have an obligation to inform your clientele. And regardless, folks should walk away from every conversation with your firm more informed than where they were when they stepped into that first conversation. And every company I touch, that's the bottom line, is did we help someone on the phone? You'll find that if you can hit that marker and make sure that you are valuable first, you are getting out of the transactional model that your competitors are in, and you're stepping into a relationship model that's infinitely more beneficial, infinitely more profitable, because, well, you can charge more for relationship than for transactions, and it's more sustainable, right? Long term, it helps you build a better practice.
I have always felt, this is just my own personal bias, that, you know, when I see a webinar or when I see somebody speak or, you know, give a keynote, if I walk away from that and say, well, that was a pretty good marketing effort. I know exactly what they want from me, and I can choose to accept that or act on that or not. That's one view. The other view is if I walk away from it thinking, man, that guy or that gal was really sharp. I was really impressed with their knowledge, their ability to present the information in a way that I can understand it, that top notch. And my, you know, I don't think they even asked for a sale. They didn't ask for any action from me. I always feel that that's the more relevant takeaway. That's what resonates with me more. And I suspect that's true with most people, or with a lot of people, maybe not most people.
I mean, I'd venture to say most people. I mean, I'll tell you, in all the companies, I mean, we're talking about what's relevant to the legal industry, but I'll tell you that this is a universal in business. And it's I'll boil it down to this. People don't buy things from you because they understand what you do. They buy from you because they feel understood. There's something in what you've presented that connects to something that's happening in their life or something that's happening in their business. That is a relationship moment. It's not a transactional one. So if I do this wonderful presentation, but I'm constantly hitting you up to buy from us, work with us, book with us, etc., that immediately is a withdrawal from this relationship that we're depositing goodwill into. And it creates this vacuum. And people don't want to work with that, right? Or at the very least, again, it doesn't separate you from your competitors. But when you have that moment like you described, Neil, where you walk away and maybe there wasn't an ask, or maybe there was, but it was, you know, minor. Yeah. If it's done tactfully and you walk away and you go, wow, you might even say, Neil, hey, you know what? I'm not in a position where I can work with that person. Or, hey, you know what? Maybe I don't need that exact thing right now. But you will remember that business. You will remember that person. And honestly, you might even refer people to them without ever having worked with them. Like, I'll tell you, for a lot of the companies that I run right now, we get more referrals from people that have not worked with us yet than people that have worked with us. And largely that's because we are preeminent educators around what we do. People know that we provide value without asking for things in return, just by being good educators. And naturally, whenever someone in our universe has a question about intellectual property, even if they've not worked with us, they think back to that moment when we were on stage and we were freely giving of the things that make us special as a firm. And we're the ones they're going to refer every time.
To give credit where credit is due, I was attending a conference in Atlanta last week, put on by Crisp Video and Mike Mogul and his folks, the Crisp Game Changers Summit. In one of Michael's keynotes, he made the observation, specifically referring to social media, but I think it applies to really all marketing activities, that social media or marketing in general is where you build trust and create demand, not necessarily where you get leads and make sales. And I thought that that shift in paradigm shift in thinking was really spot on, because more and more people are leery of the marketing efforts and the social media efforts, in large part because of the news that we see almost on a daily basis about some of these platforms. But if you can use them, as Michael said, and as you have said now, to build that trust and to create that demand through the educational process, then you've gotten the most out of the venture.
Yeah, of course. And I want to be clear and say that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're using social media, it doesn't matter if you're using a simple written blog or a weekly email that you send out to your list. As long as you're educating and you're genuinely doing it from a place of helping folks, I guarantee it'll move the needle for you. And you, I mean, you have to realize that when someone is going to work with a law firm, the thing that is going to be the differentiator for them is going to be trust, safety, your willingness to actually help others. They want to be able to trust you. They want to feel secure, and they want to know you're actually going to, you have an interest in helping other people, not just yourself. Now, I'm not saying that anecdotally. If you look, and this is where my data brain comes in, but if you look at literally $500 billion of advertising trends since COVID happened, the three marketing messages that have been most successful are trust, safety, helping others. Now, there's a significant, significant trend line in service businesses post-COVID that show that folks are tired of the idea of just, you know, get it done quick, get it done cheap, get it done fast. They want relationships. And part of that is because the world fell apart and people are looking for something stable. You do not want an attorney that could disappear tomorrow. You want somebody that actually cares about you, that's actually, you know, secure, yeah, right? That makes you feel comfortable doing what you're doing. And you want to genuinely build a relationship there, because stability is the thing that most of your clientele have lacked for the last 2 years. Everything's been in flux. So $500 billion of spend has moved in that direction. But a lot of the attorneys that I see are still just saying, hey, get a free consultation. Well, there's nothing, when I see the word consultation, my eyes are going to glaze over and I'm going to see, hey, let me sell you something.
Right.
Right. I can't differentiate between your consultation or the 15 other people in your town's consultations, because all I see is the same headline. So how am I supposed to even remember which firm I talked to? How am I supposed to know that you're different? How am I supposed to know that this is a relationship and not a transaction? You've literally put it on a billboard for me right when I get to your site.
Yeah. And it's a challenge to overcome the initial hurdle that you've set up for yourself.
Absolutely. The crazy part is there's loads of law firms that will break the million mark and never break 1.5, 1.6 million. They can break the million mark in the first few years. And I'm talking about, you know, people that go off on their own.
Sure.
And they'll get stuck, because at a certain point, you know, the fun thing about the curse really of being an entrepreneur and an attorney is that you run out of time at a certain point. And sure, you can go hire other attorneys and you can expand the business that way. But at a certain point, you tend to build a company on sweat equity up to $1 million or so dollars. And you might get up, like I said, into that 1.5, 1.6 range. But at a certain point, sweat equity is no longer viable. You run out of time. You're no longer scalable. Market factors emerge like a COVID or even like a price competition that drags the fees that you could typically charge down. And if you're not differentiating, and if you're not really trying to build a position of preeminence, you have to follow the trend to survive rather than be the aberration, right? Be the company that's able to charge more, be the company that focuses on playing above the sea of noise as everyone else goes on this downward spiral. And part of that comes from your positioning. Part of it comes from being educators. Part of it comes from avoiding doing the same thing that everyone else is doing. I mean, I can give a definite few steps that you can follow to do this.
Well, let's do that. I want to just segue briefly to say that we just had this exact conversation. Again, as an outgrowth of attending this conference that I went to at the cocktail party, I had a spirited discussion about what is the revenue cap or the limit on which solo or small firm practitioners could reasonably achieve. Was there a limit? And we got into that. The entire discussion about at what point is it just physically impossible to make any more money without doing something different. So it's a really a timely conversation. So what are some of those steps?
The biggest thing, I mean, I teach this actually, which is kind of fun. I've been doing it for the last couple of years, just going around and working on other people's businesses. But you know, the biggest thing that I always tell folks is what gets you out of Egypt doesn't get you to the promised land. So the fact that you might have made it to that 1.5 million marker and then you hit the bricks for 20 years and you just can't, like you're working harder and harder, but you're still at 1.5 no matter what's happening. You just always end up at that number. Part of it is because the model that you've chosen, the way you've architected this business unintentionally, is limited in scope. So I always talk about there's a difference between scale and growth. And I think one of the big issues is that entrepreneurs in every industry conflate the two, right? Those two terms are used interchangeably. Yeah, one is just sexier, right?
Well, we used to call it growth and now we call it scaling.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is, I think that's an incorrect understanding of what those two terms should mean. Because let me give you a hypothetical, right? Let's say for some reason Tim Ferriss calls you tomorrow and he puts you on his show. Whatever, like what always happens to Tim Ferriss's sponsors or his partners or folks that come on the show is they can experience what's called the hug of death. Are you familiar with this term?
I certainly am. Yes.
Perfect. So you go on.
I don't want the huge hug of death. I'd like a little tiny.
Yeah, you would like the caress of the support, right?
The caress of success.
Yes, exactly. So. You know, with Tim's sponsors, this happened over and over again. Like I forget what, I believe it was a company called Wild Planet. They did tuna or something. And he talked about it one day in one of his episodes and the company's supply chain exploded. Everybody that had listened to that show went and bought all of their product out and they were upside down. Like they had to be rescued because they had too much growth, too much support, and they couldn't sustain it, right?
Correct.
So there's a difference between growth and scale, because you can grow a million different factors of a company. You can grow top line revenue. You can grow team. You can actually diversify product lines and grow into new markets. You can grow all over yourself, right? You can grow traffic, grow conversions, whatever. Scale is what happens when we re-architect the business to support all that growth.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, Neil, if we decided every year for the next 5 years, we were just going to add a story to your home, your growth would be happening, but your architecture is going to collapse at some point. It's not scalable for you to grow like that. So for me, scale is a re-architecture of an existing model to support the things you're trying to do, which is why when you hit that 1.5, you know, that bulkhead that you can't break through, you hit it, you might have growth in different areas, but you always regress back to the mean. It's because you are not architecturally set up for success there and the foundation will crumble. So if you're going to re-architect, there's some important things to pay attention to. So, and this is the exact process I followed with the law firm that I'm, you know, I've been in for 2 years now. The first thing is you have to re-understand what the vision is for the company. I know this sounds very fanciful and silly, but the reality is it's very easy for you to wake up tomorrow and 25 years will have passed and you will be in a business that might be successful, but it's just a very pretty golden cage because it's not what you wanted to build. It doesn't serve the goals that you actually had for the business. It might have grown, but you might not be able to sell it now. You might not be able to hand it off. You might be, you know, unintentionally built into this corner that you have a hell of a time getting out of now.
And I would suggest that the vast majority of attorneys are in that position. They have not taken the time I have not taken the time. I'm not going to, you know, point fingers at other people. I will include myself, have not taken the time to restate what the vision, the ultimate vision of their law firm is. And as a result, they end up with a business by default that, just as you said, might not fit their needs.
Well, and it's
might really be successful, but might not fit their needs.
Correct. Because here's the thing, like, Neil, if you just made twice as much money next year, but nothing else changed, sure, you're making twice as much top line revenue, or even maybe your net doubles or something next year. That's great. But at a certain point, again, you're just building a bigger, fancier cage. Ultimately, if it's not going to end up where you really need it to for your own personal fulfillment or your own professional fulfillment, then you're just building a really fancy cage. And yeah, that's where most, I see a lot of attorneys, I see a lot of doctors, I see a lot of folks in wealth management and finance. They all end up with these wonderful companies that they don't pilot. They just follow growth. They're kind of like moths to a flame. And you know how the story ends for the moth going to the flame, right? I mean, it's
not good.
It's not good.
It's not good.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by Center Stage and the Law Firm Marketing Minute, two great podcasts produced by Spotlight Branding. We're a legal marketing company providing content marketing for law firms that actually works. And we created these shows as a free resource to help lawyers like you learn more about marketing and business development. Every Monday, the Law Firm Marketing Minute arrives with a short 10-minute dose of marketing tips and inspiration to help you grow your firm. On Wednesdays, Center Stage arrives with perspective from other lawyers and legal industry experts to help you tackle marketing and other business development challenges. Check both of these shows out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and more. Both shows make great companions for the law entrepreneur, so subscribe today. Hope to see you there soon.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. For many years, marketing companies have focused on funnels that run for a short time, often leaving dozens of leads behind that didn't make a decision yet. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. It's called a content loop, and it's changing the way attorneys think about their marketing. This system nurtures your leads in perpetuity with quality evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing actually work. If you're interested in learning more, head over to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, to learn more about the content loop and how it can revolutionize your law firm's marketing. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher return on investment. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. Well, tell me, what are some of the alternatives that we can be thinking about? I mean, I know that some attorneys would be struggling to say, well, okay, I hear you,
Well, what do I do?
But I don't understand what that means for me. I mean, I'm an estate planning attorney, or I'm a family law attorney. What are you talking about re-architecting?
So it's really simple. The first thing is there's only three ways to exit your business. You either sell it, you hand it down to someone you care about or trust, or you close the doors, you walk away, you pretend it never happened. Only one of those ways is not acceptable to me, and it should not be acceptable to you either. And I think it's very clear which one I'm talking about.
Right.
The problem is most of you, when you start your companies or these firms or whatever, you do it for, like, there's a reason you're not working in some massive major market practice. Like, you, there's a reason why you spin off your own thing, why you go out and build something of your own. But when you do that, you don't sit down and go, hey, one day I want to sell this company for X amount. Hey, one day I want to hand this down to my kid who's interested in what I do. You don't think about those things. So you don't architect them, because I guarantee you, the moment you decide to sell your practice, it's going to take about 3 years. It is very difficult for you to be completely over the business and exhausted and ready, like mentally you're on the beach already, and to maintain your revenue, maintain growth, maintain all the different things that get you a valuation and get you out of the business, which means you're going to end up taking less money for the practice when that 3 years is elapsed, right? So you set yourself up for failure, even if you can sell. Now, the other side of it is most of you architect the business around your own sweat equity team, et cetera. Right. But there's nobody wants to buy the business that's built around you if you're not going to be there. So in and of itself, that's a threat. So when I talk about re-architecting, first, know what you want. Are you going to sell it? Are you going to hand it down to someone else? Make that decision. Understand the timeline. The next thing I would ask you to do is sit down, and it's going to sound silly, but write down where you would like to be in 25 years. And it doesn't have to be with this business. So many of us, we set business goals without realizing that the business is just a machine. It's going to do whatever the hell we tell it to do. Stop thinking about the business goal for 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road, and think about what you, the solo practitioner or the small practice, what do you want your life to look like? Are you the person that wants to continue working 25 years down and you want to maybe be bringing people in and kind of bringing them up and helping them grow into this business? You can step aside. Do you want to be working full bore? Do you want to be on a beach somewhere? Do you want to be hanging out with your grandkids? Or what do you want it to look like? Because the reality is, if you're going to get to that 25-year destination, what I would ask you to do then is say, checkpoint, where do you have to be in 10 years with this business, with your life, to know you're on the way to that 25-year marker? We make a list of the 10-year markers. I say, okay, where do you have to be in 3 years to know you're on track to get to the 10-year point? We make a list of the 3-year markers. Now, what that does is it shows us where we need to be in 3 years is typically a hell of a lot different than where we are today. And we can say, okay, if we need to start having someone else take leadership, if we need to be able to start stepping aside, if we need to be able to work fewer days per week, if we need to be at twice the revenue, well, that shows us an equation that at least we can solve for. How do we make twice as much money with half your time as the showrunner? That's an equation we can solve. The business, like I say, is just a machine. So it's gonna give us whatever output we set it up to build. But if we're not intentional about what we're building around, it's just gonna spit out whatever the hell, you know, whatever the hell we kind of just feed it.
Yeah, whatever comes along.
Yeah. And that's not a sustainable way to build a business, right? You're looking for predictable, sustainable, profitable. Those are the three factors. That means you need to have intention. So it starts with that vision point. And you can see from that moment, man, I could make twice as much money, but if I don't change the very nature of the way we operate the practice, then I'm not going to reach my 25-year goal. Hell, I won't even be at my 3-year goal. I mean, we'll be totally offline right away.
What I hear underlying all of that is a dedication to a systemic approach, and maybe even a product-sized, a commoditized approach. Am I misreading that?
I wouldn't call it a product, but I would say it's a system.
Yeah.
You know, like I just was talking to, you know, the rich dad, poor dad guys, right? The rich dad advisor group about this. And, you know, we were joking about it. I mean, it's a process to scale anything. I have a decision tree that I made for them that takes them through the entire process of going from, let's say, a $1 million company to a $50 million company. And it's just a series of decisions that you make over and over again. It's very simple. The reality is the business is a machine. We all think of it as this living, breathing entity, this thing that it has its own will. And God, I hope the business is nice to us today. The business is cold-hearted. The business does not know what's going on. The business is just the result of decisions you make every single day. But we disempower ourselves by just saying, it is what it is, whatever happens or whatever seems like an opportunity to make money, we'll go chase that thing. And we build ourselves into a corner. So if we start with the vision, it makes it much more clear. And then what you see, Neil, is I might have a massive operations issue. I might need to realize that I'm handling way too many things as the showrunner now, and I need to be a better delegator. I might go hire a COO, or I might go hire a project manager. Or what I might see is I need a way of doubling revenue without spending as much time that I'm spending. So I might go and look at who are other attorneys I could hire that would offer different services or expand that sort of product line that we can offer to diversify what we're doing. I might look at things like, okay, simple as this. If we need to make more money with less of my time, we might double our prices. I can tell you that might sound scary for a lot of folks that have been price competing for the past few years, but I've done that literally hundreds of times in different industries, and I have never seen anybody double their prices and lose 50% of their business. Every single client comes out ahead every time. If you double your price, the most I've ever seen anyone lose is 20% of their business, which means you still come out significantly ahead.
Sure.
The other upshot of that is you just got 20% of your time back. So you're more scalable again.
Let me pivot here for a second in the time that we have left.
Sure.
Because I know that you've had a lot of success and have helped people steer their professional services businesses in a way that allows them to create teaching mechanisms or courses, for lack of a better word, that are in and of themselves systems to which you are describing. In the professional services world, how does one go about doing that? Because I know some attorneys who have set up courses as a mechanism for scaling, such as you suggested, courses that clients can go through and reap the benefit of the legal expertise that the attorney has in a way that doesn't require the attorney to be hands-on directly. Is that realistic?
So it depends on what you're hiring the thing to do, which is an annoying phrase that I say over and over again to all my clients. The reality is, if your goal is to give amazing legal advice through a course where you're not there, I will 100% tell you that is foolhardy. Okay. Because giving legal advice is a very personal sort of thing, right? There are generic, you know, umbrellas that you could kind of throw out there, and that's fine. But to differentiate and to be valuable, what I would focus on educating your clientele on is more about the process in and of itself. Because if somebody's going to be an informed, educated client for you, that is someone that's easier to sell. Like you might, I mean, I don't know how many of your folks have sales teams, but we do now. And one of the big things at the firm that we did was we educated clients so that by the time they were on the phone with our sales team, they were pre-motivated, right? They were pre-qualified, essentially. They'd already been through our process and they knew what made us different. So when we did say our price, which, by the way, we're priced significantly higher than the vast majority of our competition,
okay,
they don't balk as much, because they understand what the difference between us and a freaking legal Zoom might be. Right. And you know, that's the biggest thing, right? If I would tell service provider sort of folks, especially legal, financial, the biggest thing you guys would use education for is differentiation, not monetization. Everybody has got this raging focus for monetization. But I would tell you that if we look at that how to scale anything flow, it's vision first, then business models and assumption testing, higher end offer structures, monetization, validation. If you look at those steps, monetization is probably the least important. What I mean by that is not you don't have to make money.
Right.
What I mean by that is everyone tries to scale the marketing and sales side. You know, how do we make more sales? How do we convert more? How do we get more leads? But volume is a very poor metric for scalability, right? That's just growth for growth's sake. Developing and testing a better business model, developing and testing assumptions that you might be making about your price threshold, what your clientele's looking for, what you can offer. Those are things that are exponential growth areas, right? And those kinds of shifts in the architecture itself is what makes us scalable. So if we focus on, is this model as optimal as it could be for the vision that we just re-clarified? Chances are it's not. So now if we look at what are some changes we can make, what are some things that we can shift around, how can we change our offer structure in and of itself? It's significantly easier to generate a lot more revenue to build a more scalable business from that frame than it is to just say we need more leads. And that reductive look at business growth is part of what holds a lot of attorneys back. And it's, I think, honestly, one of the greatest crimes that the ABA is perpetrating against you guys is not allowing you to have folks that are not attorneys be owners in the business, because the reality is you are not learning how to run companies in law school.
No, and that's the whole purpose behind this podcast. Tell me a little bit about using curriculum-based educational systems as the internally within your law firm to onboard new attorneys, or define systems within the firm such that you can then make yourself more scalable and therefore more desirable as an acquisition target later down the road?
Such a good question. So I mentioned earlier about selling the company, and I said no one's going to want to buy the thing if it's reliant completely on you. This is why you create internal training. So for example, if I'm the main attorney in my practice and I've got maybe some associates or something like that, and I want to make sure that they are, we're more scalable, that they can kind of graduate into a leadership position, then I want to kind of do a gap assessment on where they are versus where I need them to be. And I'm going to start looking at the things I do every day. What are the skills? What are the things? What are the processes, essentially, that I have to do right now that I can't trust them to do yet, or that they're not prepared to do? And I'm going to start putting those in and documenting everything. Because the more clear my documentation is, the easier it is for them to graduate as internal leaders, and the easier it is for us to go bring in external hires and make sure that they get up to speed quickly. Because all of us know, especially in the legal field, not the most progressive technologically field, a lot of the things that we do are hacked together. And so you go to one firm and their hacked together solution is a hell of a lot different than another firm's hacked together solution. And so you end up with this pretty significant amount of time spending onboarding and getting people ready to go.
Is it as simple as developing policies and procedures manual that defines all these systems, or is there something more concrete that you're suggesting?
There is, because realistically, this is where we get into the actual curriculum development side. Anything that you do as an educator, whether it's internal education or external education, everything should always start with a mastery goal. This is a phrase that I've coined. And a mastery goal is essentially what you want someone to walk away from it being able to say. So anytime we write a mastery goal before we start planning a program, it's written in the point of view for the person that takes the program. Now it might be, you know, now I can file copyright application, blah, 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 blah. And you might be creating this for your administrative staff so that you can scale operationally. It might be something as simple as, you know, understanding the process for how we enter a new client's information and move them through the sales process so that everyone on the team understands what the heck's going on, mm-hmm. right? Those sorts of things, if we start with an end goal, then we can say, if I'm going to get them here, what's the very first thing they need to understand? And we start focusing not on just general, you know, okay, here's the task. Let me just write up a document or let me build the binder. I want to focus more on what are the skills that they would need to acquire in order to do this properly, to do this at a really high level.
I see.
Skill-based ascensions is how you can create better training. This is something, for example, well, you know, we've done this with corporations where they're trying to build internal universities now because education's become very expensive and why not make our own engineers is basically the thought process. So what they're essentially trying to do is shortcut the onboarding flow that they're seeing when they bring in new hires that now have to learn the way Google does things. Or they have to learn, like they have the base skill set, just like any attorney you might hire into your firm has the base skill set. But then if you look at, I think it was like the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, they were doing studies on employee turnover. On average in the US right now, you have 18 months. Okay. Now in the legal field, it's a little longer. I think it's like 26 months or something when we were looking at it. But either way, once someone does turn over and kind of exit the company, it takes on average 6 months to find the right person, not just a person, but the correct person. And then the studies on their productivity say they don't reach peak productivity for over 12 months. So your opportunity cost of losing people and not having great training is extremely high. That's why these companies are trying to develop almost internal universities all over the place, because it is quite a bit cheaper than going out and having a really great recruiting arm of the business, right? It's very difficult to find that stuff and find people that are ready-made and then eat a year of poor productivity or, yeah, you know, gradual acclimatization, right?
Sure, sure. Well, listen, Joe, there's a whole lot more we can get into. I'm trying to distill what would we want our listeners to walk away from to remember? Because we covered a lot of ground here. So what's your take on what the listeners should be focusing on in terms of understanding scalability and growth as a potential?
I would say the biggest thing right now is if you look at the landscape that you're in and the things that you complain about every day, yeah, you know, the prices decreasing, all of these, you know, the commoditization of what we do. The two biggest things that you have to focus on are, is this business as it stands today capable of delivering on what we're asking it to do for us, like as people, not as business owners, but as the folks that are running it? Is this business on the right track? And if it isn't, then we need to focus 100% on the transformation of the business in terms of, are we differentiating ourselves enough? And that can be a differentiation using education. It can be differentiation using a shift in the model. But both of those things are focused on this overall idea of getting the business to the point where it is scalable and able to reach that bigger vision that we are kind of architecting for. So the reality is, if the business is not heading in the right direction today, you are not going to wake up 5 years from now and it will magically be going in the right direction. It doesn't work that way. So get ahead of it. Start thinking about, how do you differentiate? How do you bring scale into the equation? If you're not hiring the business to do what it's currently producing for you, you are running on a trend line that leads to disaster. every time.
I think for me, the observation I would have is that in listening to you, the key hurdle is to recognize that your law firm, one, is a business, and that as a business, it operates as a system. And the system will generate whatever you set the system up for. And so if you don't have that system aligned with your objectives and goals, it's just not going to be successful.
100%. So,
Joe, tell our audience how they might be able to reach out to you and follow up on anything you've had to offer today, which is considerable.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, you can find us at teachtoscale.com. We host a weekly free education. I mean, I call it office hours, and I'm sure a heck of a lot of you are familiar with that from law school.
Sure.
I've been doing it for 3 years straight every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific. So, you know, it's an open door thing. You guys come in and ask any questions you want about where your business is. I don't pitch or sell anything in there. It's just kind of a public service. And I'd love to see some of your folks in there, because I frankly do have a hell of a lot of experience in scaling, you know, in the legal space. And that would be where I would send, you know, most folks is.
Well, we will have that reference in the show notes. And I would encourage people to drop in, because I know for a fact that it, as you said, it's not a sales opportunity. It is literally just exactly what you described it as. Office hours, drop in, ask some questions, learn something, exchange information with others. It's an offer, really, you can't refuse.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe, for being a guest here today on The Law Entrepreneur. We really do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Well, how about that? That's a wrap for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors once again, as usual: Daylight by Market Circle, Spotlight Branding, Ruby, as in Ruby Receptionists. If you have a chance, swing on by our website at www.lawentrepreneur.com. You can check out a bunch of information and resources there. And if that doesn't satisfy your needs, swing on by our Facebook page or Twitter. You can find those just by simply searching for The Law Entrepreneur. And if you'd be so kind, I would greatly appreciate it if you go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and an honest review. If you find this podcast is helpful and that you're getting value out of it, it does help with our visibility and ensures that we're going to be there for another 5 years or so, as this has been quite the run. And I'm greatly appreciative of your interest in The Law Entrepreneur.